welcome to the House of Commons. This is a regular podcast about politics. I'm Mark Thompson. I'm a political blogger and commentator. And every week we get a guest on from the world of politics and or journalism to discuss the two or three biggest political topics of the week. And I'm delighted to be joined by James Ball, who is a Guardian journalist. Hi, James.
Hi there. Good to be on.
Good to have you on. So the first thing we're going to talk about, which we cannot avoid by law, I think, is the seven-way debate. The kind of, I think it was described in advance as like the Borgen-style debate. I'm not quite sure it was as elegantly done as as Borgen. Although I've never seen Borgen, I'm just guessing from what I've read about it. Did you see the debate, James? I presume you did.
So I did not see it live. I had the joy of being on the train at the time, so I followed it on live tweets and then caught it on time lapse, which was much less dramatic.
Spoilers. If I'd have been watching it as live later on, I'd have stayed away from Twitter because it would have ruined it for me. Well, I'm one of these people who hate spoilers, so...
It's, well, you know, the twist halfway through was something.
No one saw that coming.
Staged, but I'm a little worried we're going to have to give equal time to all seven candidates on the podcast, though.
No, we won't. My rules here. So what did you think then? What's your overall impression before we start picking the bones out of it?
It made me think Cameron knew exactly what he was doing when he only wanted a seven-way debate. It sort of gave us everything that we wanted. I mean, my immediate impression came much more from the polls than from watching it, really. And that was, you got a messy four-way tie across three polls, which meant that every paper could write whatever it wanted to anyway. And so I think essentially there were some good performances and some bad performances, but it left us exactly where we were an hour before it happened, really. Is that too dismal?
Well, no, I mean, I think you're right. I think Cameron did know exactly what he was doing. And I think the fact that I think there were three polls afterwards, one of which had Cameron and Miliband tied. Another one had, I think, Miliband 1 point ahead, but it was like 25 versus 24, so it's well within the margin of error.
Yeah, that was the ICM poll.
Yeah, and there was another one that had Nicola Sturgeon out in front. It was one of those things where basically everyone could claim a victory of sorts in whatever way they wanted to. So certainly what you didn't have was any very clear win for anyone. And that was exactly what Cameron wanted to avoid. I think if he'd have had a head-to-head debate with Ed Miliband, really all Miliband would have needed to do was turn up and not trip over his shoelaces, and he would have been seen to, in quotes, win the debate. Because even if he didn't win it, as in, the polls afterwards, didn't have him winning it, that wouldn't matter because the Tories have painted Miliband as a kind of stumbling, bumbling idiot. And if he doesn't come across like that, then he just wins by default.
I think they've really overshot on villainising Miliband, actually. I think the debate strategy has paid off. I think the seven-way did exactly what they needed it to and neutralised them. But they've really sort of pushed this idea of, Miliband totally useless, way behind his party, weird, can't even eat a bacon sandwich. And it's really bad expectations management. And it's kind of showing in Miliband's poll ratings. I've only seen up-to-date Savation polls, which are, it shouldn't be taken as gospel. But he's gone from having negative ratings of about minus 14 all year to plus 4 in the new ones. He's had a decent week. He had a good Absolute Radio interview, which I doubt broke through. But the fact is, they sort of set the expectation game so low on Miliband that he comes across fairly decently as a normal, quite nice person when he's got the circumstances to do it, like most politicians. And so I do think they've made an error there. And unless Miliband makes some howlers, I think his ratings will carry on improving. And that might actually just help keep Labour's sort of vote share propped up. I don't think they'll get a huge breakthrough, but I don't see where a big drop-off comes from.
I think the danger for the Tories as well is that a kind of big Mo narrative starts getting behind Miliband if that continues, because, he's starting from such a low perceived base, given how they've traduced him over the last, ever since he became leader, really, but it's intensified in recent months. Then actually, that almost becomes an interesting story. Oh, this guy isn't as bad as everyone thought he was going to be.
Well, there comes that thing, if you're not writing him off as a weirdo, I mean, that's fatal. It was sort of the Kinnock problem. It didn't matter what he said. you know, you just saw him, you know, I mean, gosh, it's a long time ago now, 23 years ago, but you saw him stagger over on the beach or sort of sound a bit strange. And people don't listen to your policies. If people sort of snap in, they've got a few decent grabby things at the moment. If what we've got on offer now is all we're going to get in the manifesto, they'll struggle. But if they've got a couple of good fat cat policies, a decent housing thing or two, and something clever to say about, you know, about regular families and benefits, you could see them suddenly, people going, oh, actually, you know, they're not all that out of touch. And so I do wonder whether they took it too far with trying to make a joke out of Miliband. You know, they maybe should have left that to the newspapers.
Do you think Cameron is going to be, because I've talked about this the last couple of episodes of this podcast that I've done, do you think he's going to be damaged by the fact that he's so blatantly body swerved a head-to-head debate with Miliband, or do you think he's basically got away with it now, because he can now claim, I did do a debate, if anyone says, well, why didn't you do a debate?
Yeah, and I think the things that aren't debates that look a bit like them, you know, the sort of the Sky Channel 4 one, the sort of Q&As in succession coming up. I think they look enough like debates that he'll get away with it, especially given, I mean, the one thing that has to be said, there was so little actual debate on between the candidates on Thursday. You know, it was like a US primary debate.
Yeah.
It was quite dismal. 2 minutes, 40-second rebuttal, 30 seconds. And anytime they got some free flow, which was barely ever, you know, poor Joel Etchingham kind of had to step in to make sure people were getting time.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, I was speaking to my family about it, who are well outside this kind of bubble, and they were very angry with her. They said just as anyone was about to make a point or finally land a blow, she cut them off. She actually did a good job with the format. But, you know, to people at home, it was quite frustrating. It didn't feel like they were latching in.
Yeah, I felt sorry for Juliet Jingle because she had an almost impossible task of trying to balance everything. And exactly like you say, the problem is what you started to get was some back and forth between, you know, a couple of the debaters a few times. But the problem is if she'd have allowed that to carry on, then what you just would have had is 5 minutes of two people talking to each other. And then she would have had to be thinking, OK, so they've had a bit too much more time now. So now I'm going to have to not let them have as much. And that would have just been impossible. So that's why she really, rigid format had to be stuck to.
Did an impossible job.
Yeah.
Like very, very well. But to people who don't understand all the nuance of that, I think she seemed overly aggressive.
Yeah,
I mean, sort of on a, we've talked about the two big parties. I thought Leanne Wood's contrasting approach with Nicola Sturgeon was really interesting. Sort of really just pressing on Wales, keeping it to that, keeping to quite a traditional nationalist line, compared to Sturgeon, who, you know, talking about our country, about the UK, about UK-wide issues.
Yeah.
And almost pitching to a UK-wide audience was really interesting.
Leanne Wood didn't even pretend she was doing that. Every answer that she gave, she said, you know, of course, you know, people in Wales, and it was just Wales over and over again, and Welsh. And she didn't even try to do anything other than talk to her own, you know, her own constituency or constituencies. And so then when the polls come out and she gets like 4%, you think, but actually, if all of those 4% are in Wales, that's really good.
She's
for
actually
her.
Had a really good breakthrough. Yeah. It's the interesting thing. She kind of absolutely vanished from the conversation afterwards because she polled very badly nationally. But, you know, Wales is really small.
Yeah.
And so if she really busts the dials there, and I have to admit, I didn't actually look into the subgroups, I should have done. But I suspect it might have played better relative to her base in Wales than Sturgeon did in Scotland, although Sturgeon could do no wrong there, really.
Yeah.
But I thought, you know, maybe Leanne Wood did better than she was credited for. And, you know, when you start to look at the others, Farage did exactly what you expected to. And I could see his comments costing him in the long run.
Do you think? Because I think it felt a little bit like a core vote strategy from him. I mean, the HIV immigrant thing seemed like trying to shore up his base, which, given where UKIP were a few months ago, that's actually quite surprising. He's no longer looking outwards. He's definitely looking inwards, as far as I could tell from that debate.
Yes, I think when you're on, I mean, their polls are sliding. I mean, average it out there. You know, if you want to be optimistic, they're on 15. Well, optimistic for them, they're on 15. If you want to be pessimistic, they could be as low as 11. And to be doing a core vote strategy when you're there, when you were in the mid-20s just months ago, I mean, that's defeatism. I mean, I think if that's the best he can do, if that's the best pitch he can make, if he really can't widen at all off immigration, he's going to struggle to have more than two or three seats. You know, I mean, they were never going to get more than 10, but what they really wanted was to have a much higher vote share than their seats sort of indicate, to obviously beat the Lib Dems, ideally, if not in seats, in votes.
Yeah.
And I'm getting less and less convinced they can. I mean, they just always were going to get outspended and sort of outdone in the attention stakes in a general election. But I am wondering whether sort of the wiser heads who perhaps said after the European election, this will have faded a lot by election day, are being more vindicated than we thought they would.
It's almost like a kind of a more elongated version of what happened with the Lib Dems in the 2010 election after the Cleggasm. You know,
yes.
Which was that everything kind of went ape. I mean, I was a Lib Dem at the time, and I remember the kind of, you know, the euphoric feeling that was coursing through the party. But there were wise heads saying, this won't last. It won't last. And by election day, you know, the vote share will have returned roughly to where it was at the start. And that's pretty much what happened. And I think you've seen a similar dynamic with UKIP, albeit over a much longer period, in that I think the European elections and the council elections held at the same time. I wouldn't necessarily say they were the pinnacle, because you also had the Clacton by-election and the Rochester and Strood by-elections, and they were probably, you know, similar highs to that. But it's not surprising that the vote has started to slide and will probably continue to do so as it gets closer to the election. And, you know, first past the post, you know, enacts its brutal reality on the situation.
Yeah, Farage just didn't seem like a man prepared for a general election, though. You can absolutely get through Euro elections and by-elections on your own issues. And in general, you need a few answers that aren't immigration. You know, of course we expect that to be his number one, two and
but
three.
He's becoming a parody of himself, though, is the problem. It's like, you know, every issue, immigrants.
Yeah. And there hits a point where that seems old, even to people who do blame immigration for a lot of their ills.
I think you're right.
And I do think as well, you know, a lot of people who are anti-immigrant, they're not vicious, they're not spiteful. You know, they have concerns in a sort of way that perhaps those of us who are liberal, who are metropolitan, might not always feel comfortable with. But I do honestly wonder if the HIV thing was a misstep. I think there are people who would think that was very tacky. I can't imagine Douglas Carswell was at all comfortable with that.
I can't imagine Douglas Carswell is at all comfortable with most of what comes out of Farage's mouth, though.
Yes. It's, you know, I do think it's one of the tragedies of modern politics that Douglas Carswell's ended up with UKIP as the only place he could be in, actually. So I don't agree with him on much, but he's an interesting politician.
Yeah. And let's just rattle through the other people, because we've talked about Miliband, we've talked about Liam Wood, we've talked about Nigel Farage. We haven't really talked much about Cameron, other than that he's basically got away with it, you know, with his kind of twiddling his moustache as he exits the building. I mean, how do you think he did during the debate?
He's still got this habit of seeming furious when other people talk. You know, I think he does have to try and get past this, doesn't he? But I mean, he did fine, really. He's polished, he's okay. I do think his temper still seems to just get the better of him. I think he just about kept a lid this time, but there's a certain petulancy, and I can't work out if it comes from him or from his advisers, but he's done a few things that look a bit angry and look a bit small and a bit prime ministerial. You know, I think the debate performance was okay, but he didn't seem, you know, you can remember seeing Blair particularly alongside other party leaders, and he just seemed like a prime minister in a way the others didn't. Cameron did seem like a polished, competent performer, but not in a different league. And, you know, it did just remind me of the sort of cheapness of standing outside number 10 and making personal digs at Miliband.
Yeah.
You kind of think he doesn't show a great deal of... I mean, I don't think he has a vision to articulate.
Well, it wasn't
and
classy,
so
that,
he
was
ends
it?
Up in quite a... He ends up doing quite petty, odd, disjointed, tactical things.
Yeah.
And yeah, I mean, it just seems to be there's, I don't know what the Conservative vision for Britain is.
Yeah.
I mean, you could say they have a lot of parties, but you know, his is the one that's had the largest saying running the country for 5 years. I don't really know what they stand for.
Yeah. I mean, I'm sure I'm not the first person to have made this observation, but Cameron strikes me as a kind of two-dimensional facsimile on pretty shoddy paper of Tony Blair. He's tried to ape him in all kinds of different ways, and he just never quite gets it right. And he just, you know, he's not as good as Blair. You know, I see him questioned sometimes in debates and in, you know, other forums. And I just, sometimes I sit there and I think, how would Tony Blair have answered that question? And always, I mean, maybe it's a little bit of kind of, you know, harking back and things always look better in hindsight, but he always seemed to have the right answer to questions, even when, you know, I'm thinking of his masochism strategy before the 2005 general election.
And yes, I remember that seeing was him, clever.
Yeah, he was sitting in a studio in front of a studio audience, and he was getting absolutely barraged with questions, and he held the line. And you know, he came. I remember seeing him. I think it was the Paxman interview at that same election, and I was really pissed off with Blair by this point. I mean, I had been a Labour voter back in '97. I think I'd left, abandoned voting for them by 2001. But I was really annoyed with him. And after half an hour of being questioned by Paxman, I remember, I think I turned to my wife and I said, I can't remember why I'm not voting for him now. You know, and I never get that feeling with Cameron. I'm also not going to vote for Cameron, but I never sit there and think, oh, actually, I'm not really sure why I'm not voting for him. I always think, yeah, I'm still definitely not voting for you.
It's possibly a voicing your unpopular opinion thing, but I've always felt Cameron and Obama, of all people, share a failing. And it's, I think their political ambitions were completed when they reached office.
I don't think either of them were
people who had something they wanted to do. I think they wanted the big seat.
Yeah.
And I've always had the feeling with Cameron that he became prime minister. That was it. He got the sticker, you know, he got the trophy.
I think a lot of his colleagues think the same. I'm sure I've read something where, you know, some of his Tory colleagues have said that that's one of his problems, that he fulfilled his life's ambition the day he walked into Downing Street. We're going to have to.
I was going to say, you know who we haven't mentioned, though, don't you? We've all started work, there's so little to say, but, you know, sitting there seventh unregarded is Nick Clegg.
Well, we'll come to Clegg in a minute. How did you think Natalie Bennett did? I have to say, I thought she was awful.
I don't know if you spotted, but my Guardian colleague Alberto Nardelli tweeted the 10 most Googled searches through the debates, and one of them was what's Natalie Bennett's accent, and related searches we heard were can an Australian be prime minister, which I quite enjoyed. But I mean, she was clearly better than in her interview with Andrew Neil. You know, I think they have a difficult argument to articulate. I mean, I think they're at real risk of being the naders of this election. You know, a vote for the SNP, you know, a Labour voter swapping to the SNP is swapping to a party that, you know, depending what you believe, but is more likely to prop up a left-leaning government than a right-leaning one. A vote that Labour lose to the Greens really does only help the Conservative Party. And so they really have to sell that there's a vision that's very different, that's sensible, that's workable, that at some point could have a part in a mainstream coalition. And I don't know if they have that yet, and I don't know if what they do have is best articulated by Natalie. I mean, she seems a decent woman, a thoughtful one, but you know, I think she was much improved, but I doubt she changed many minds.
Well, I tweeted halfway through, imagine how much better Carolyn Lucas would be doing than Natalie Bennett, and you know, it's quite sad to say, really. But, and I felt sorry for her, actually. She seemed incredibly nervous. During her opening minute, she looked down at her notes about 8 times. Now, maybe she was just looking down because she was nervous. Maybe she wasn't looking down for prompting, but she looked to me like she was looking down to remember the next word she had to say. And that, you know, you should have that opening speech absolutely committed to memory. But, you know, after the various media missteps she's had over the last few weeks, it wouldn't be surprising that she was nervous, but it really showed, sadly.
I may be imagining it, you know, but I'm pretty sure I remember reading something that was essentially along the lines of she was incredibly reluctant to be leader. She didn't particularly want it and more or less ended up with it in very greedish fashion. And I could sort of believe that. And, you know, maybe I've just wildly imagined it, but I always sort of, I have a little more regard for her because of this potentially made up fact. Where I just think, yeah, actually, suddenly, especially when there's a big surge for your party, that pressure, that sort of difficulty and that scrutiny, if you didn't really wholeheartedly want it, has got to be quite tough. But, you know, sympathy is not a... it's not a good quality for a leader to evince, really.
No, not really. Okay, well, we've delayed it long enough. Clegg, go on then.
I mean, it wasn't 2010, was it? So that's
very much not
all you can say. I honestly, it just made me wonder, like, it's like seeing a knackered out plough horse or something, and you're just sort of thinking, you know, why hasn't he been put out to pasture somewhere, really? He didn't seem to be enjoying it, and he seemed to know he was damaged goods. So I don't know, am I overreading it? Did he do better than I think?
I don't know. I mean, I have very great difficulty in kind of objectively determining how Clegg has done in situations like this. I remember during the two debates that he had with Nigel Farage before the European elections, and I thought he wiped the floor with Farage, certainly in the first one. Maybe the second one was a bit more marginal. But the polls afterwards made it clear that, you know, 70-odd% thought Farage had walked it, and I think the second one it was like 80%. So, you know, it was like just one of these situations where I just, you know, I think my own internal biases were taken over. I thought in this one, I thought he did okay, and there were flashes of what he was like in 2010, but there was no big moment really. And I thought Cameron dealt quite effectively with his attempts to, you know, put clear yellow water between him and what the government had done. You know, Cameron very deftly said, well, you know, we sat in the cabinet and we took those decisions together, Nick. And, you know, and I stand by those decisions. I don't know why you're trying to distance yourself from them. Now, the answer to that question is actually quite straightforward. It's not an answer that Clegg will ever give. But the reason that why Cameron is quite happy to, you know, stick to the decisions they've made is because what the Lib Dems have done is dragged him more into the centre ground of politics where he wanted to be anyway. Whereas all the decisions that the Lib Dems have made that they didn't, you know, that they wouldn't have made as a party on their own have dragged them further to the right and away from their support. So that's the reason why.
Perhaps in a way that Nick Clegg was not uncomfortable with.
Well, he might not have personally been uncomfortable with it, but his party definitely were, and the people who vote for his party were. And that's the problem. Whereas what Cameron has been able to do is almost moderate the right wing of his party. Imagine if the Tories had got in with a 5 or 10 seat majority. He'd have been held to ransom by the Peter Bones
hugely,
and the...
Hugely.
Exactly. But so he didn't want that. He's probably secretly glad that he had the Lib Dems, at least for his first term.
I do understand the distancing strategy as an election sort of proposition. I do think whoever advised Nick Clegg to go for Cameron so aggressively, what you've done in government essentially on his first intervention, I thought that was very silly because Cameron was always going to respond like that. It was always going to kick up the bile of anyone who's going to sort of essentially think you travelled to the palace together 3 days ago. Well, a little longer, but not much.
It's only a few days since we saw them walking out into from the back scenes into the Rose Garden on that coalition programme. So, that's quite fresh in certainly political geeks' minds anyway.
And probably just about enough of the, you know, he's got enough name recognition, enough sort of awareness for people to know that he willingly and sort of knowingly kept the government going. And so to suddenly turn and attack as an outsider, I mean, Cameron was always going to find that easy to deal with.
Yeah.
And it just, you know, he, fair or not, he's got a reputation as a bit of a snake. And so to do something that looks two-faced and deceptive was very, very silly. I just don't feel like he has a great deal to help his party. I think there is a positive Lib Dem case to make. I think there's a positive need for a party with its agenda. I just don't really understand how Clegg furthers it. And I'm surprised, given that it's not usually a party that's known for its gentleness towards its leaders, I'm surprised he managed to sort of still be the face of it for 2015 with so many people eyeing their seats.
I think we could have an entire podcast about, you know, the internal dynamics of the Lib Dems and why Clegg is still leader. Maybe just for this podcast, though, we'll park Clegg for now, as indeed the entire electorate might do in a few weeks' time.
Yes.
It pains me to say that because I've met him a few times. He's a nice guy, and you know, I'm still a fellow traveller with the Lib Dems, but it's not looking good. The final politician we haven't really talked about too much is Nicola Sturgeon. We alluded to her at the start, but wanted to talk about Nicola Sturgeon in a bit more detail, not least because we're recording this on the evening of Saturday, the 4th of April, and today the story has broken that Nicola Sturgeon allegedly, she denies it, and it's also denied by the French ambassador, that she allegedly claimed that she would prefer David Cameron to become Prime Minister than Ed Miliband. And also, there's an allegation that she said that she didn't think that Ed Miliband looked particularly prime ministerial. As I said, this has been denied. And it's still not really clear how we've ended up in this situation because I was reading some analysis of how these transcripts work, and it does seem quite unlikely that, you know, this memo would have would have been written if it wasn't at least some reflection of a truth quite similar to what's been reported. But what do you think about this? I mean, the reason why I kind of have linked these two things together is because really the only reason why Nicola Sturgeon is in the news today is because she actually did very well during the debate. I thought she came across well. She clearly came across well to people in Scotland, and she topped one of the polls, which for, you know, leader of a party that's only contesting seats in Scotland in a UK-wide debate is actually quite incredible, isn't it?
I mean, it's extraordinary. You know, Scotland is a tenth of the electorate, so to poll 28% on a national stat poll is pretty impressive. I mean, it wasn't people saying they'd vote for her, it was people saying that they'd do best. But yes, I mean, I found her pronoun use really interesting. She kept talking about our country and our nation in relation to the UK, which for a separatist leader is actually sort of fascinating. You know, on the broader thing, on the broader issue of, you know, it's really propelled her up. I think there's a lot of strange moving pieces. I mean, a lot of the conservative strategy relies on scaring sort of voters below the border about the idea of SNP being in a coalition or having a sway on the balance of power. And if she comes across that well and can continue to do so, it might completely undermine what's been one of the central planks so far of the Tory strategy. And so I'm surprised that they're doubling down on it, really, in their adverts. And so you then get The Telegraph, which has very, very much been the house paper of the Conservatives lately, getting this leaked memo. It was fascinating. But I mean, the sort of details of this story, as you say, the memo saying that Sturgeon thought Miliband would be a weak PM, etc. It seems to be the Telegraph got a great story and then completely bungled their handling of it by not going for comment or reaction first and not sort of putting in the caveat in the note, which was, seems unlikely this would have been said, maybe lost in translation. And so what it seems to be is a second-hand civil service note written by a supposedly very reliable and down the line civil servant who wasn't in the room, based on the account of someone who was. And it was supposedly a very hurried meeting, you know, almost, but not quite, something in a corridor. And so I kind of feel by if they'd have gone and got the denials first and sort of done a memo says this, First Minister's angrily denying it, but then she would say that, wouldn't she? They'd have got a very clean and strong hit. But you know, they don't, and it says a lot that actually this must be the one time I think I can ever remember where people are, certainly in Scotland, trusting the word of a political leader over a newspaper that has shown documentary evidence for what it's saying. So I think it was a very good get by them. And Jeremy Hayward, the head of the civil service, has launched a leak inquiry, which is a good sign that there's definitely some truth at the core of all of this. But Sturgeon's response seems to be quite clever. Just coming out in the Sunday papers, which are sort of being tweeted as we speak, is a sort of new offer of a progressive austerity alliance to Labour, which will be an interesting thing for Miliband to react to. You know, does he try and sort of sound positive about it, but say we'll talk about post-election, see if he can outflank the Greens, or has he got to feel like he has to rebut them to counter Tory attacks? I mean, she has managed to throw it back into someone else's court, I think. I think it will work.
Yeah. And I think Nicola Sturgeon is a much better politician than a lot of people think. And I don't, it's not an accident she's ended up leader of the SNP. I also think the way that the SNP have played the post-referendum situation, so Salmond has stepped down, but he's standing for Westminster, he'll probably win a seat. And if the SNP do have substantial troops in Parliament, and he, I mean, I'm assuming he's going to become the leader of those troops, even though obviously he
Surely,
isn't at the moment.
surely.
They can't not have that. That must
I mean,
happen.
there are two politicians with name recognition in the SNP, and he's one of them,
Yeah,
so.
exactly. So that's got to have to happen. But then the kind of the trench warfare that will be required in Parliament, I think he is absolutely the one to do it. But the figurehead of Nicola Sturgeon as the leader of the party, you know, more generally, and therefore, you know, the figurehead in the lead up to the general election, I think is the absolutely right thing to do. I think if it had been Salmond in the seven-way debate, I don't think he would have done as well. I think he's too well known, and he's too known as the kind of canny, tricksy Scot, and I just don't think he would have come across that well. Certainly not to anyone outside of Scotland, anyway.
Salmond plays brilliantly in Scotland and terribly outside.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you know, which doesn't matter usually for the SNP at all, but for the national politics of the campaign, I suspect Labour is quite glad Sturgeon's the face of it rather than Salmond, because otherwise I think the attacks would be much more damaging. But it is fascinating that essentially Scotland has suddenly, even in the aftermath of the referendum, when everyone thought it would sort of fade out of the national conversation again, you know, this nation has got this sort of outsized influence on the national as well, essentially because it's, you know, it looks, if you believe the polls, like becoming almost a one-party state. I
Yeah.
think maybe the SNP's greatest accomplishment has been to be in government for years and not really have any of the electorate notice.
Yeah, well, it's
So.
because they can play the game of both being the government and also in opposition to the Westminster government. So they play that game very, very well. And I think they.
Magnificently. I mean, that it is a talent.
Yeah. Okay. I think we should probably park the debates there. Then, as said, that's the only actual debate that will involve Cameron and Miliband. But there will be other set pieces that don't involve head-to-heads as we get closer to the election. So we'll obviously see how they go. The last thing just wanted to talk about just before we finish is something that actually annoyed me. But then I've been a campaigner on drugs policy for years, so this was bound to annoy me. And also, I used to be a Lib Dem as well. Labour released a leaflet a few days ago, which was attacking Lib Dems, and it says, I've got it in front of me: Lib Dems soft on crime, drugs, and thugs. Almost 17,000 fewer police. And then there's actually like a set of bullet points, saying what the Lib Dems have done. And the last bullet point says, and they would end prison sentences for drug possession, even for the hardest drugs like heroin and crack. Now, this caused a bit of a storm. I know there was a piece in The Independent. There was also a piece in your own paper, The Guardian, James, about this, which I think is where I picked it up from initially. I mean, I'll just vent my spleen
Of course.
just for 30 seconds or so. I mean, I suspect that people in the senior Labour leadership, and Ed Miliband in particular, know that the current drugs policy regime is actually damaging, you know, some of the most disadvantaged people in this country. And I think the classy thing for them to do would have been to just pedal soft on this issue and not, you know, not attack a progressive policy being suggested by one of the political opponents. But it just seems like they just can't help themselves. It's so hardwired into Labour's, you know, attack mechanism to attack anyone who, you know, is perceived as soft on drugs. They've been doing it for so long, and they were very tough on, or tough in quotes, in on by their terms
Idiot's tough,
when they
yeah.
were in. Well, exactly. Yeah, I mean, they sounded tough, you know, and they. Although they did loosen the regime on marijuana from B to C, they upped it back from C to B again when Brown got in, again against the advice. And I just found this profoundly depressing because, I mean, I suspect in 20 or 30 years' time, marijuana will probably be legal and probably some other drugs will be legal. Maybe heroin and crack won't ever be legal. But I'm sure that the current legal regime won't persist in the face of the evidence for another several decades. It's going to have to change at some point. But it just seems like so petty to go for a party that is trying to, be more evidence based on this issue. And I just, it's frustrating that, that they feel like one of the four things they're going to attack the Lib Dems for is something that really they shouldn't be attacking them for at all. But then I suppose I would say that, wouldn't I?
Yeah, well, I mean, coming from somewhere where on the policy I'm entirely sort of in favour, but I just think more broadly there's some problems with Labour being aggressive on drugs. I mean, it does undermine evidence-based policy, etc. We know the harms argument. To anyone who looks at the stats, looks at the figures, looks at the data, the arguments against relaxing sort of drugs policy and changing how we tackle it and getting more and more to a medical approach is clear. So, but leaving the policy aside, because we're in an election time, and so the evidence has nothing to do with it. I'm not sure they're quite still in line with their voting bases. They think they were. I think public opinion has moved a long way on marijuana and on various other things. And so you sort of you think on one level maybe it's not quite the electoral sort of easy goal it once was. And then just as conviction politicians, as I think a lot of them are, drugs are one of the major things doing harms to Labour's heartland communities, to working class communities, to cancer states, to all sorts. And actually, to sort of turn one of the issues where you could actually find common ground with the Liberal Democrats in a party, in a parliament that's likely to need a coalition, seems a needless bit of swiping and attack that's going to make some very easy headlines if you want to try and do something in the first year of a new government.
Yeah.
I think if you're going to try and do anything constructive on drugs, you would have to do it in the first year of a new government that you thought you could have a few years on. Because if you can start to get these things working, no one will mind. If you try and do it within 6 months of an election, you'll eat it.
Yeah.
So I sort of thought it was silly, and I thought it was needless in a crime leaflet, because to be honest, the other points in there were completely fine. They talk about frontline police cuts, and if you look at the cuts on the budgets of the police services, they've been brutal, and what's planned is huge. If you look at the sort of needless farce of PCCs, I think that was a silly policy worth attacking. And if you look at what's going on with the fragmented probation service, it's a mess. I mean, the semi-privatization, the sort of gaps between it, the fact it's almost all gone to for-profit companies, you're going to have people, I mean, you are going to have people die as a result of that reform. And, that will become known soon too. And so you had a lot of grounds if you wanted to try and attack either coalition party from a partisan view. You didn't really need to throw the drugs thing in.
Yeah.
I think at times Labour just has a view of its voter as Alf Garnett. And it just, it throws in, as racist as it dare, a line on immigration while trying not to upset, its middle class base. It throws in some anti-drug stuff. It just feels like the when Labour panics, it suddenly doesn't want to show any conviction for something. And so they'll say, no, we want to crack down on benefits more. We want to, of course, we want to control immigration. Why wouldn't you want to control immigration? Oh, yeah, drugs, terrible, lock them up. It seems to be Labour's default panic reaction. And I really wish they would learn better because I don't think it helps them.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're right. I think that they are not in the same place as quite a lot of what you would consider to be their natural supporters. I mean, I imagine if you went to, a typical council estate and you talk to people there, because they will see it day in, day out. The idea that if you've got someone who's addicted to heroin, then, the right thing to do with that person is to put them in prison. I mean, even as I'm saying those words, it's preposterous. If someone's addicted to heroin, that's a health problem. They need help. They need help to, try and get off the drug or try and, manage that addiction. I mean, in decades, in centuries gone by, when people were addicted to opium, they could get by. They would manage,
Yeah. I mean,
doctors and.
when it's right next to you, what you want is for it to go away. I mean, you want the problems with heroin are where you're near the house where everyone shoots
Yeah,
up.
of
And
course.
if you shut one down, they open another. If you shut,
Yeah.
you want something to make the problem go away. And things like increasing access to it medically, et cetera, whatever makes it go away will be popular.
Yeah, but I mean, the reason why you have these crack houses and the smack houses, and it's, you know, it's as sordid and as seedy as it is because it's illegal. You know, if it was legalized, and I, but you know, I'm preaching to the converted here, I can tell, and I have talked about this issue so often that I have bored myself rigid. But it just is so depressing, because what it signifies, as you've said, actually, is that if there is some kind of coalition or some kind of confidence and supply situation between the Lib Dems and Labour, this is one of those things that will get negotiated away in exactly the same way as it got negotiated away with the Conservatives. There was no way that the Conservatives were going to do anything on drugs policy. And it's now becoming abundantly clear there is no way that Labour will. So, you know, sadly, no matter what the Lib Dems' intentions are on this policy, there are just far too many MPs across the House that will just not have anything to do with it. And it's difficult to see that changing.
It would be something that would help a lot of people who Labour want to help.
Yeah. So, absolutely. I mean, I was interviewed by an academic a few days ago on this subject, and I went off on a bit of a rant for about half an hour, which made me feel a bit better. I'm not sure how much they got out of it. But they asked me, one of the questions was, when do I think that this is likely to change? You know, when do I think marijuana and perhaps other drugs will be legalised? Are you still there, James? You haven't left.
I am. Yes,
I heard a door close. I wondered if even you'd had enough of this discussion. I said, I don't think it's going to come from our politics. I think it will come from outside of our politics. I think it will be countries like we've already seen with Portugal. And there are countries in South America, and there's even American states that are starting to legalize some of these drugs. And I just think eventually it will just become so obvious that we're going down the wrong track, because there will be so much evidence from these other countries and these other territories where drugs have been legalized and everything hasn't all gone to pot, like, sorry, no pun intended, and everything
if you
hasn't
want a fun
gone
thought
terrible.
Experiment though, imagine the Daily Mail headlines and the UKIP outrage if it came through the EU.
Yeah, so and that's a sad indictment of our own politics, because I just can't see how our own politicians are going to grasp the evidence on this, you know, from an intrinsic way. It's going to have to come extrinsically, unfortunately.
It's either going to just have to be that or shifting public opinion. I think if you could show Labour enough surveys showing C2s especially had moved on drug policy, if the opposition wasn't strong, I don't think they'd have to be vastly in favour. You might just be able to get some cautious first steps.
Maybe. And maybe the other thing is,
it's sad that that's the optimistic scenario, really.
Yeah, I mean, maybe the other thing is the demographic shift, that just as, you know, in people who are over 65 now are the ones who are most likely to vote. I think like 78% of over 65s voted at the last election, and only 44% of under 25s voted. But probably most over 65s at the moment never really experienced drugs when they were younger. But just as the demographics change and change and change, there will be more and more people in those older demographics who just, you know, were in around drugs, maybe took them themselves, or if not, at least knew plenty of people who did and no harm came to them, etc. In fact, the biggest harm that was likely to come to them was from getting a criminal record rather than the drugs themselves. And just as time goes on, but this is a very long game we're talking about here. And, you know, these little skirmishes that we see like this just set us back, sadly.
Yeah. Well, it just makes you feel we're not there yet, doesn't it? It's
Indeed.
Not, you know, I don't think we're going to see big drug policy changes in the next 2-3 years, which is probably the life of the next parliament, if you're an optimist.
Okay, good stuff. Well, thanks, James. Thanks very much for your time. It's been good to chat.
So thank you very much for having me. That was great fun.
Yeah, and enjoy the rest of the campaign.
How could I not?
And I'd just like to thank Audio Boom, who very kindly hosts the podcast for us on the internet. And I'd like to thank Kevin McLeod at incompetech.com for our theme music. And we'll be back soon.